We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
And good morning, and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. At the end of last month, President Obama made a surprise visit to Afghanistan to meet there with the country's leader, Hamid Karzai. Clearly, the administration hoped that American concerns over a number of issues, including government corruption, would make more of an impression if they were delivered in person by the president himself. Instead, what the United States got shortly thereafter were some angry comments from Mr. Karzai, who said if the international community didn't stop criticizing him, he just might go and join the Taliban. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about current events in Afghanistan, try to talk a little bit about what the current American policy is toward Afghanistan, and look at this very complicated and now kind of tense relationship between the government of Afghanistan and the United States. And the guest we have this morning is Devin Haggerty. He is a professor and currently chair of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He has written quite a lot on the politics of South Asia and also on the issue of nuclear proliferation in the region. He's here in our area, and we're pleased that he could come and spend a little time with us to talk. Questions here are welcome. The number, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And you may email your comments and questions to will-talk, so that's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. At any point here, questions are welcome for people who are calling in. We just hope that they can be brief. That'll help us keep moving along. Thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
There, we had a very significant, I think, change in direction in Afghan policy when we moved from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. And the criticism of the Bush administration had been that in focusing so much of its attention and resources on Iraq that it had neglected Afghanistan, and that made it possible for the Afghan government to further weaken, for the Taliban to strengthen and mount something of a resurgence. Made possible at least in part by the fact that they could spend time over across the border in Pakistan. And so the Obama administration, when they came into office, they said, well, we really need to do something about Afghanistan. And as people know, I'm sure, made a very serious commitment to send more soldiers there. So can you talk a little bit here now about what exactly is the Obama administration plan right now for Afghanistan?
I think the first thing to remember is that what's going on in Afghanistan today and what we're involved in as a country is a war. And that was not something that I think a lot of people appreciated up until very recently. What the Bush administration tried to pursue in Afghanistan from about 2003 right up to the end of the administration was referred to as a stabilization operation. It was an attempt to sort of hold the line and hope through development assistance and assistance to build up the democratic political institutions in Afghanistan that if we could hold the line in terms of security, the Afghans would eventually get their act together and develop a government that can actually govern, an economic system that can actually provide opportunities to their people and do all of those things that a state actually is supposed to do. President Obama came in at the same time that there was starting to be within the U.S. military a fundamental rethinking of what our role was in Afghanistan and what our mission should be. And the Obama administration has now fully accepted the fact that what we have going on is an insurgency against the government in Afghanistan, an insurgency that is led very loosely by this organization we call the Taliban, but which also has many different local variants around the country. They are fighting a war to do no less than to topple the government of President Hamid Karzai. And the United States has responded to that by really rethinking our entire presence in the country. And what we're pursuing today is a counterinsurgency. The buzzword around Washington today is COIN, counterinsurgency. Mm-hmm. And there is a whole literature of counterinsurgency doctrine. General David Petraeus is very much at the center of that. And a counterinsurgency essentially is an effort that combines military, political, economic, and social means to try to prevent the counterinsurgency from succeeding and toppling the government, and also at the same time to shore up the existing government and economic system. But the bottom line is it's a war, and I think sometimes we forget this. We tend to caricature the Taliban as just sort of terrorists or you know, ragtag bands of militias that belong to different warlords in Afghanistan. And there are aspects of terrorism to what they do, and there are aspects of warlordism. But I don't think we should be shy about saying that we are fighting a war in Afghanistan in the same way we were fighting a war in Iraq in 2007. Mm.
It seems that the maybe one kind of consistency between the two administrations' policy while it's true that the Obama administration has made this really significant commitment, put in a lot of troops there, said we're going to go over after real hard, we're going to go after the Taliban. There is a time limit here. I think the administration knows that there's only so long that the American public's going to put up with this, and only so many people they'll be willing to see die, and only so much economic outlay here. So they've said, well, you know, we're looking here at a time frame of maybe about another year, maybe two. And at the same time, they made this commitment to try to strengthen the Afghan government, its security forces. And the idea is that we're going to do as much damage to the Taliban as we can. But at some point, we're going to have to leave, and the Afghan government is going to have to take over this task. So taking that apart in two pieces, it seems that what I'm reading now is there are a lot of people who are starting to say that there's no way that we can really militarily defeat the Taliban, not at a cost that we're willing to pay. Do you think that is correct?
I do. I think to defeat the Taliban militarily, that is to put them out of business, would require hundreds of thousands of U.S. and or allied troops, would require a multi-year commitment that in terms of the American political process and the American political cycle would be infeasible, and is just not something that we as a country today, I think, could sort of coalesce behind. Essentially, what the administration is trying to do is it's trying to pursue, I would say, four major objectives right now, and you identified a couple of them. The first one is to rebuff the insurgency. For much of 2006, 2007, 2008, if you were sort of toting up the score in sort of the Taliban versus the government, you would have to say that the Taliban was winning in that it was taking over sort of everyday governance and taking control of territory in more and more districts around Afghanistan. So the government's control was actually shrinking and the Taliban's control was increasing. What we're trying to do is stem that tide and also reverse it. And that's what we're seeing militarily, both through the International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF, and through a separate American-led Operation Enduring Freedom Force. And General Stanley McChrystal is the commander of both of those efforts to deal with the insurgency on the battlefield. So that's number one. Number two is that we are trying now to secure population centers and to protect the people from either being recruited into the Taliban or being so intimidated by the Taliban that they don't accept the legitimacy of the government. We're very much trying to save lives and to create conditions of security such that normal everyday economic activity can be undertaken, that people can go to their jobs, that kids can go to schools, that development projects can move forward and things like that. And, you know, security in some sense is the foundation for everything else you're trying to do. because if you have insurgent forces that can sort of randomly blow things up, it's much harder to tear something down than it is to build up in terms of economics and political control. So that's the second thing, secure the population. The third thing we are trying to do is we are trying to build up what's called the Afghan National Security Forces, or ANSF. And that is a combination of the Afghan National Army on the one hand and the Afghan police on the other hand. Right now, there are roughly 100,000 Afghan National Army personnel and roughly 100,000 Afghan police. Unfortunately, during most of the Bush years, we kind of dropped the ball here. And it's pretty extraordinary if you look back to how successful we were in prosecuting the initial stage of the war in 2001. We've had 8 years since then, and the army is still 100,000 people in a country the size of Texas with a topography like the Rocky Mountains. It's not a very big force, and it is also sketchy in terms of quality across different units and things like that. The Afghan police, it has to be added, is a very corrupt organization. Oftentimes, police units are nothing more than the personal bodyguard for provincial governors or warlords or tribal leaders. It's a stretch to call them the Afghan police because they are pretty heavily in the pocket of just about whoever controls whatever local area they're in. So that is another part of it, is to train up those forces so that, you know, if and when we start to disengage from the country, you know, Obama said maybe 2011, maybe 2012. The time frame is iffy, and you don't want to be very specific about the time frame. We will be handing off control to these security institutions, but clearly they have a long way to go, and clearly that training process is extraordinarily difficult. I mean, you have to contrast, for example, what it takes to train a young American to come into the U.S. Armed Services. You know, as an enlisted person, that person would normally have a high school education, would pass a variety of entrance tests and things like that, and be educable. If you come in as an officer, you have a college degree, and obviously you're educable to become an officer. In Afghanistan, you're bringing people in who have little to no education as we would know it. And very little capacity to be trained in a very sophisticated way that is going to allow them to be effective law enforcement or army people. And the last thing that we're trying to do is we are trying to work with the government of Pakistan in such a way that the other problem that you mentioned can be addressed, and namely, that's the problem of these Taliban forces in Afghanistan being able to simply melt away across the Afghanistan-Pakistan border to recoup, to rest, to retrain, to get patched up, to take the winter off, to do all of those things that insurgent forces can do when they have sanctuary and a sanctuary that's away from the counterinsurgency forces that are targeting them. So we're trying to deal with this. I'm sure heard the term AFPAC. That's a kind of indication of the fact that we now see this as these countries being so conjoined that you can't separate out Pakistan policy and Afghanistan policy. Pakistan has come a long way in the last year and a half to accepting that they have their own very serious internal insurgency going on, and that these two insurgencies feed off each other. And so they've taken more steps to be more aggressive in the border areas. But the Afghan-Pakistan border is still to this day extremely porous. And it's not like any border we would have in our mind as Westerners. If you go across the U.S.-Canadian border, you're not seeing border checkpoints like that on the Afghan-Pakistan border.
Well, I have a couple of callers here. I promise I get right to them. But just to round this out, given the situation that you've described, the pretty certain fact that that we cannot decisively defeat the Taliban, again, at least not at the cost we'd like to pay, that we have a problem here with our partner, the Afghan government, is weak. And there's a lot of issues of corruption. There is a lot of people around the country don't really think too much of the central government, or at least they don't think that the government's in any position to do much for them, that chances of the security forces being really ready to go to take over the task within the next couple of years seems kind of a long shot. Do you think we're at a point here where the administration is actually going to have to change its direction or to do something different?
I don't think we're at that point yet, because actually the administration is right now still actually in the early stages of implementation of the president's new policy that was under consideration for month after month after month in 2009. We saw the initial large counterinsurgency operation in Helmand province in the last couple of months. That succeeded in essentially chasing the Taliban away out of Helmand. And then in the aftermath of that military success, if you want to call it that, what we've been doing is moving in, trying to shore up local government institutions, trying to create economic development practices, and trying to safeguard the population there against a return of the Taliban. And that has arguably been a kind of pilot project for the types of operations that we're going to be seeing. The real test is going to come this summer, basically. And the real test is going to be another very large operation in Kandahar province, in particular around the city of Kandahar itself. And this is really, you know, we'll know a lot more about what the future holds by, say, September or October, because Kandahar is sort of the capital of the Taliban insurgency. When the Taliban first came to power in Afghanistan, they came to power in Kandahar in 1994. That's where Mullah Omar was based, and that's the base camp out from which they subdued most of the rest of the country and took control of Kabul in 1996. The city is one of Afghanistan's largest cities, nowhere near the size of Kabul, but I think the population is around 1 million people. It is going to require an extraordinary degree of coordination among the different elements of the NATO alliance that's fighting in Afghanistan to move into Kandahar to try to dislodge the Taliban forces that are in and around the city. And then essentially the word's not being used, but essentially to set up an occupying authority. And that's, you know, that's we're contemplating nothing less, because what we have seen is that in the past, obviously the U.S. military in a kind of, you know, mano a mano engagement with the Taliban is going to win militarily. But then the U.S. military has always pulled back and the situation has returned to Taliban control because, you know, the government is really not functioning very well in most of the country. There aren't economic opportunities in most of the country for people. Public services are pretty terrible in most of the country. This time, under the new Obama doctrine, what's being planned is, you know, General McChrystal has called it, you know, government in a box. We're going to basically, in the aftermath of chasing out the Taliban, move in civilian experts from various Western and other allied governments. We're going to move in the NGO people to start their development projects. We're going to try to get schools up and running. We're going to try to make the electricity work better. We're going to try to really do all of those things to create a livable society in what is a very deprived, impoverished area. And then at the same time, secure the population of that city to move back to some sort of context of normalcy. We'll see. That's a very big ask. One of the reasons it's a very big ask is because across the border in Pakistan, you have Mullah Omar based in the city of Quetta in Balochistan, and he's got his Taliban forces down there and his leadership structure down there. And, you know, who's to say that the Taliban won't make a decision to essentially leave before this operation even starts, drift into Pakistan, rest up to fight another day in the full knowledge that given the American sort of political cycle and American attention span on these things, that we're not going to stay indefinitely. And so there's a real tension in this policy, and the administration is keeping its fingers crossed that the Karzai government can get its act together and create real governing structures and real economic opportunities that will prevent the people from turning against the government and siding with the Taliban if and when they come back. It's a big test. It could be very bloody. Nobody really knows whether the Taliban is going to try to, you know, view Kandahar as sort of this is our home base. We've really got to put up a fight here, or if they're going to be content to just sort of drift off and plant their roots elsewhere for a while. It's an open question. And clearly, since we're signaling very clearly where we're going, we don't have the element of surprise or anything like that. And one of the reasons for that is because our political process is such that it's very transparent. We have to work very closely with our NATO allies, you know, Germany, the Netherlands, the Canadians, et cetera. And they have publics that are very skeptical of their military presence in these countries. And it's, you know, I would say if I were a betting person that, you know, 3 years from now, is Kandahar going to be the kind of stable, well-governed, reasonably secure place that we hope? I would say the odds are against.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Devin Haggerty. He's professor and currently chair of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's written a lot on the politics of South Asia and also on the issue of nuclear proliferation in that region. We're talking about Afghanistan. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller to start off in Indiana, line one. Hello.
Been worth the wait, actually. Very clear and perceptible things going on by your speaker. I have a general question. I'm one of those people from the Vietnam period, distrust about anything anybody comes up with in the military. And this one thing you've been talking about, that the general's talking about going in and helping out the population and stuff, I wonder if you could go through that quickly. The history to it. It sounds like standard operating procedures to me, and we always seem to fail at it, whether it was the French in the beginning and us at the end or what. It seems like, are we already looking ahead on other places on the planet where this is going to occur? Because it sure is going to occur again. And I'm wondering if the model itself is screwed up, not just the tinkering around with it. And if any of that's clear, could you give me some answers? Thank you.
You've raised a very important question, and it's true that a lot of the things that the administration is trying to get done in Afghanistan are things that we tried in Vietnam, and obviously a lot of the so-called lessons of Vietnam are being applied to this current situation. I think that, you know, if you were to compare the sort of civilian side of the counterinsurgency approach in Vietnam and Afghanistan, I think this is a more sophisticated approach. It's, you know, in Vietnam we had things like the strategic hamlet program where we would actually build, you know, bamboo fences around villages and essentially imprison people to keep them safe from the Viet Cong forces and from away from Viet Cong recruiters. Clearly, that was a misguided effort. What is being attempted here is really no less than sort of social and economic development, not actually being done by the military forces, but being enabled by the military forces. In other words, the military forces are intended to first chase out the Taliban and then set up defensive formations around the city of Kandahar and to have really a very light footprint in the city itself. We don't want these pictures going out over the airwaves around the world of, you know, American military forces standing on street corners in Kandahar essentially with a city that looks like it's in lockdown. We want the military to be providing a context for which civilian aid workers, humanitarian aid workers, civil servants from the Afghan government and from other governments can go in the hundreds and really try to inject into Kandahar all of those things that we associate with a functioning, healthy, vibrant society, whether it's schools, whether it's public health facilities, whether it's you know, providing enough, having enough security that commercial operations can get up and running, whether it's building new roads, whether it's building new electricity generating capacity. That's what we're after. And I agree with you that there have been a lot of mistakes made in the past. I do think that there is more potential in this approach simply because it's a more kind of comprehensive way of doing things. And I think the military and the political authorities view the alternative as being unacceptable. And the alternative really is to pursue a kind of straight military strategy against the Taliban and let Afghan society sort of fend for itself. The problem with that is that in that kind of situation, without the civilian side of things demonstrating to the population that we are going to be there, that we're on their side, that we're providing them with basic services, they really have no incentives to support the Afghan government and really every incentive to simply bide their time and wait for the inevitable moment when the Taliban moves back in.
Another caller here, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. I question a lot of the premises that you began with, and not to be seen as a critic of just the Bush administration, but you emphasized that, you know, Bush was encouraging development and democracy. Well, that's only if one warlord, one vote is a democracy, and it's a meager amount of development aid that was accepted as being a corrupt tool to pay off people is development aid. So, and I'm afraid that Obama administration and powers that be, and the Pentagon particularly, are not that much evolved from that. It's just that these commonplaces about the U.S.'s commitment to democracy and development, I just think, are totally unfounded if one really looks at the record. One consults people from the region like Tariq Ali, who has a major book on relations between U.S. and Pakistan, which apparently the intelligentsia here don't bother to even read to debunk. And Ahmed Rashid, who one has to overlook the fact that he was an insurgent in Baluchistan against one of the military dictators in his youth. But they say that things are completely different. This capture of a high Taliban official was really apparently done by the ISI because they didn't like the fact that Karzai was talking to him without the Pakistanis on at the table. That there are so many things. The U.S. basically wants a compliant regime there that won't talk to India and Iran about a gas pipeline. There's already tension about that with Pakistan. It's so much different. It really is. And if one consults these authors, they both call in their own way. They're pretty polar opposites in some way, Ali and Rashid, for going from a great game, which is what we're playing still, to a grand bargain, which would involve all of the regional powers and even the NATO powers, which, frankly, the previous NATO chief said that, you know, one of the reasons we're in Afghanistan is because of its strategic position in the world, Central Asia, fringe of China, the whole thing. I mean, he wasn't that explicit, but that's really what if one peels back what's going on, is what's going on, I assert. And the fact that one can talk this long without actually acknowledging some of these divergent opinions is just immensely frustrating and tragic, because it's going to bring home more American soldiers in various states of death, disfigurement, and et cetera. Thank you.
Let me just address one of the things that you talked about right at the end there, that the issue of, you mentioned a grand bargain, other people talk about it in terms of a reconciliation process that would bring elements of the Taliban back into the political process. That's very much on the agenda of the administration. And what sounds to you like a long disquisition on the subject feels to me like too little time to talk about all the subtleties of what's going on. But the administration, the NATO allies, the Karzai government, the United Nations itself, all are moving toward a consensus that there is no way that there's going to be any kind of peace and stability in Afghanistan without a political settlement that involves reconciliation with those Taliban elements that can be essentially induced to come back into the political process, to lay down their arms, to become part of the government in Afghanistan rather than part of an insurgent force that's attempting to bring the government down. So, the fact that that wasn't talked about before doesn't mean it's not going on, and everyone is very aware of that. Back to a couple of things that you raised at the very beginning of your comments. I think I couldn't disagree with you more on just about every one of them. If you look at the foreign assistance figures, the United States has spent on Afghanistan between 2002 and 2010 $47 billion in economic and security assistance across the board. Building schools, building roads, public health facilities, all sorts of things like family planning programs, efforts to help Afghan women. If you look at the beginning of the 2000s, right after the war of late 2001, early 2002, you had 1 million Afghan children in school at that time. Today, you have something like 7 million Afghan children going to school every day. Something like 8 out of 10 Afghans now has access to reasonably decent public health services, an unprecedented figure in that country historically. If you look at the government itself, yes, of course, it's a flawed government. And it's not that the international community went in there and tried to transplant some sort of Western democracy. It actually was very respectful of Afghanistan's own indigenous Loya Jirga process, this process where you bring in tribal elders and other local elites to be a part of sort of consensus, the equivalent of a constitutional assembly. Afghanistan has a parliament today. The parliament is increasingly outspoken against the Karzai government, increasingly holding his feet to the fire, increasingly actually supporting a lot of the aims of the coalition that's in Afghanistan against Karzai's centralizing efforts and against his tendency to, have truck with too many bad actors in Afghanistan to effectively be the arms of his government in distant provinces. We also have a situation in early May where there is going to be another Loya Jirga in Afghanistan. It's now scheduled for, I believe, the 2nd of May. There are roughly 1,400 people who have been invited across the Afghan political spectrum. This is representatives from the Karzai government, representatives of all the provincial governors, representatives from every district in Afghanistan, representatives of every tribe, every ethnic group, every religious group, religious minority. There are representatives from women's groups, which have become very vocal in Afghanistan over the last 8 years with the help of the foreign assistance programs that we've been paying for in Afghanistan. That group is meeting to try to, A, assess whether the government that's been established is the right one for Afghanistan today. And there are a lot of reasons why most people, myself included, think it's not the right structure of government. And if they reach that conclusion, B, what is the way forward? How can that government be restructured, reformed in such a way that will decentralize real political authority around the country and effectively allow for the people to have more voice in their immediate governance? So the categorization of the United States as just, basically in this for oil purposes or to try to be the referee of where the gas and oil pipelines go through the region. That's just, to me, a very jaded perspective on the kinds of things that we've been doing. And actually, I think it disrespects the efforts of the American military and a lot of the humanitarian aid people, NGOs, UN personnel, et cetera, who have been sacrificing themselves in some cases, jeopardizing their security in a lot of cases to work to build up this country.
We're moving into our last 15 minutes here. I have some other callers, and I have an email here I want to get into. Our guest is Devin Haggerty. He's professor and currently chair of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He has written a lot on politics of South Asia. We're talking about Afghanistan. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have an email here from someone who poses this question. He says, if Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, is known to be in Quetta in Pakistan, and the Pakistan government is unwilling to take him out. How can we say that Pakistan has the same objectives as the United States? He goes on to write, it seems to me that the disease is in Pakistan and we are trying to treat Afghanistan.
Very good question. We can't say, first of all, that the United States and Pakistan have the same objectives. They don't. They're two separate countries. They have two sets of national interests. And as with every two countries in the international system, there's going to be overlap between their national interests and there are going to be conflicts between the national interests. Here, to kind of delve into this question a little bit deeper, we have to understand that there are essentially, and this is a huge simplification, but essentially two different Taliban movements. There's a movement in Pakistan. There's a movement in Afghanistan. The Pakistan government in recent months, the last 12 to 18 months, has realized that the Taliban insurgency in Pakistan is a threat to the Pakistani state. And they have unleashed the Pakistan army on their Taliban. And they've made inroads and they've had successes in stemming the insurgent tide in their own country. Then there's the Afghan Taliban. Pakistan was instrumental in creating what became the Afghan Taliban in the early 1990s. They created the force. When I say they, I'm talking about the Pakistan Army and more specifically the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence Organization in Pakistan, created the Taliban as a political movement that could go into Afghanistan and impose stability on a country that was mired in civil war, that had been devastated by the Soviet Union for 10 years, and that was just kind of eating itself alive. Pakistani strategists were worried that this instability, sort of chronic instability, would ultimately infect Pakistan, would ultimately jeopardize Pakistan's ability to be as strong and secure as it wanted to be against India. The Pakistanis continue today, some elements in their government, to support the Afghan Taliban. And this is one of the reasons why they don't go in and effectively apprehend Mullah Omar and shut down his operations. The Pakistan government sees a political role for the Taliban in the future of Afghanistan. And effectively, the consensus that I talked about with respect to the previous caller, that the Afghan Taliban has to somehow be brought back into the political process, at least elements of it. The Pakistanis have known that all along because the Afghan Taliban represents the south and eastern Pashtun populations of Afghanistan, very important populations. And to have any kind of legitimate government in Afghanistan that doesn't include those Pashtun leaders is not going to have any hope of controlling most, if not all, of the country. So, you know, they're not playing both sides against each other. It's just that they are, I would say, in it for the long term. They recognize that the United States is going to leave at some point. The United States has always had a point where it has left. And when the United States leaves, they want to be able to have some say in the future governance of Afghanistan. And that's why they don't put these guys out of business. I think it's also arguable whether or not they actually could put them out of existence. And here you can debate whether, you know, decapitating the leadership of a movement puts it out of business or not. I'm not so certain that if they take Mullah Omar and his senior leadership out, that would necessarily deal a crucial blow to the Afghan Taliban. I think they're, you know, they're 50,000 or so strong, and I think they do have a second generation of leadership that I think would be able to sustain their momentum pretty easily.
I have a couple of other callers here I want to get, but I do want to quickly get in a question here. Maybe you can talk at least a little bit, and then perhaps we can come back to it. To what extent is the government of the United States really talking about trying to deal with the Taliban or some elements of the Taliban? And are people in the United States government really saying to have a stable Afghan government, it's going to have to be a coalition and it's going to have to involve some Taliban?
We're not saying that very publicly. American officials aren't. Privately and in sort of political military circles, I don't think there's anybody that disputes that elements of the Taliban are going to have to be part of the political solution. What is going on here right now is that the administration hopes it can deal enough of a blow to the insurgency to convince insurgents, individuals within that movement, that they cannot win, that they will not see a reprisal of their victories in 94, 95, 96 that ultimately made them the government of Afghanistan, that that's just impossible. It's not going to happen. And once that realization sets in, that's the time at which you can begin to peel off people who are sort of on the margins of the movement, who've joined the movement maybe because they need money, who've joined the movement because of a lack of other economic opportunities. You know, that when I say that the figure is roughly 50,000 Taliban fighters, we're not talking about 50,000, you know, fully indoctrinated, you know, willing to die for the cause individuals. There are a lot of very pragmatic actors out there who are pursuing their livelihoods by effectively joining the only organization that's got a job for them and a gun for them and $10 a day for them. So it's hoped that the people who are less committed to the insurgency, less ideologically driven, will see that this is a movement that's not going to be the winner, may not be the loser, but it's not going to win, and that therefore maybe the winning bet is now on a kind of revitalized government and a revitalized economic process. And that's, you know, anyone who thinks they can predict the outcome of that is I think, lying to themselves. David, there's one more thing I want to interject here just contextually, and I think that sometimes we forget this. This is a country, Afghanistan, that has been at war now in some way, shape, or form for 32 years, since 1978, when there was an insurgency building against the Marxist government of Afghanistan, supported by the Soviet Union. 1979, the Soviets invaded. They spent 10 years there. They killed somewhere between 1 million and 1.5 million Afghans and drove another 5 or 6 million of them out of the country. The Soviets pulled out in 1989. Then you had these Afghan Mujahideen groups going back into the country, and you had a civil war. The Taliban came in 94, 95, 96, imposed its control, imposed a very repressive brand of Sharia law on the country. You had a little bit of stability, but you still had the Northern Alliance contesting that government. You know, that takes us up to 2000, 2001, the September 11 attacks, the World Trade Center, et cetera. And then you have the Operation Enduring Freedom, which takes down the Taliban. And then you have the things we've been talking about for the last 8 years, from 2002 until now. If you look at that 32 years and you look at the Afghan population and the age structure of the Afghan population, those people who are 32 and younger don't know a stable, relatively calm, relatively normal society. They have no experience of it. And if you, you know, do a little bit of mathematic jiggering, you can say, all right, so that means really that nobody under the age of 40 has moved into adulthood in any kind of a normal society with normal educational opportunities, job opportunities, where any kind of aspirations for a decent life had any real hope of being realized. It's a traumatized society. And so you have here, you know, we talk about, wow, can we pull off what we're trying to do by the summer of 2011 or maybe into 2012 before we have another presidential election? In the short term, you know, you don't come out of the kind of historical trauma, multi-decade trauma that the Afghans have been enduring and turn things around that quickly. I mean, I think the best that can be hoped for in 2011 or by 2011, 2012 is that the tide has been turned, that the situation is no longer sort of slipping into an abyss of you know, poverty and national degradation, corruption, instability, et cetera. I think that's the kind of – we want to be able to leave saying, okay, we're on an upward trend. We're confident we're leaving behind security forces that can secure most of the country. We're confident we're leaving behind a government that can actually govern most of the country. You know, obviously not everything's not going to be perfect there, but we're confident that we're leaving behind a situation where we won't see al-Qaeda be able to move back in and to establish a headquarters and a sanctuary there and carry out repeats of the 9/11 attacks.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. Some of the callers here. Let's go to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm afraid I'm going to have to be very parochial here, sir. It seems that these problems stem not just from our situation in Afghanistan, but entirely from our complete process that we're dealing with in the Middle East and in Southwest Asia, whatever you want to call it there. And until we get more even-handed all the way around, we're not going to have any kind of way to deal with all these problems, period. And I mean, I'm talking about all aspects of people there, both, the Israeli or the Palestinian, Arab, Iraqi, Iranian, all of them. We have to be able to be more even-handed to everybody and even more with our policy. Because if I understood what you said, we're going to help them fix their infrastructure, and we ourselves have an infrastructure that's falling apart too. We're trying to give something to somebody else that we can't even afford for ourselves. And we're not even willing to be even-handed with all of the combatants. So how in the world can we ever possibly assume that we're going to succeed?
Well, that's a very, I would say, diffused question that brings a lot of different elements into it. Clearly there are, it's artificial to some extent to separate the situation in Afghanistan from the situation between India and Pakistan or the situation in Iran next door to Afghanistan or Iraq next door to Iran. But I do think that, clearly there are national security interests that if we look back to 9/11 and we look at the fact that Pakistan today is a nuclear weapon state facing its own problems, that the insurgencies in Afghanistan and Pakistan are linked together. I don't think it's misguided to talk about this situation in its own terms. I don't think it's necessary to bring in every other situation. I mean, clearly foreign policy is linked, but these are issues that I think, if we were to assess what the Obama administration is doing, you always have to look at foreign policy not in terms of should we do this or should we not do this. It's not, accept this Obama doctrine for Afghanistan or not. It's an assessment of the relative prospects for success of different policy alternatives. The main policy alternative that was being discussed in terms of Afghanistan that was being put forward by an interesting kind of coalition of some people on the left and some people on the right, like George Will, was not to have a counterinsurgency doctrine and strategy, but to have a pure counterterrorist doctrine and strategy, which would involve many fewer Americans actually being in Afghanistan, many billion dollars less in spending on political and economic and social development in Afghanistan, and a more kind of standoff counterterrorist limited campaign just simply with the goal of ensuring that al-Qaeda cannot set up camp again in Afghanistan. In other words, it was, you would send cruise missiles in from American ships in the Arabian Sea. You would use predator drones to disrupt terrorists from consolidating and conglomerating. You would effectively use America's high-tech capabilities in a purely counter-terrorist fashion. And sort of the view was, we can't be responsible for or obligated to help deal with the situation on the ground in Afghanistan. That may be the plan B that we move to if all of this fails. But I think that in order for that to be a legitimate approach, I think that we did that it was necessary to apply a more comprehensive attempt to effectively rebuild, reconstitute, and redevelop a country that, as I said, has been at war in one way, shape, or form for 32 years.
We'll try to for one more caller in Urbana on line one. I have to ask you to be brief, but please go ahead.
Okay, just a quick question on the drug trade and how does that, your thoughts on how that plays into this whole situation. Thank you.
Yeah. Give you about a minute.
Big question. It's pretty rare that you get an hour into a program without talking about the narcotics problem because Afghanistan is the biggest producer of opium poppy, which becomes heroin. And I think something like 75% of the heroin that ends up on the streets around the world comes from Afghanistan. Very quickly, this is fuel for the Taliban. The Taliban it raises an incredible amount of money for its operations from narcotics production and processing and sales. We are working very seriously as part of that $47 billion of foreign assistance to deal with the problem and to provide Afghans with other forms of agriculture that can replace narcotics. But unfortunately, it's, you know, poppy grows wild around Afghanistan. It's the easiest thing to grow, and it's the only option for a lot of very impoverished rural Afghanistan, rural Afghans.
I don't know if it's possible to say something in about 30 seconds, but what do you make of this recent angry outburst from President Karzai shortly after Mr. Obama was there?
There's been some speculation about his stability, frankly, mentally, whether he's sort of lost the plot. Clearly, he's got a lot of different audiences that he's trying to address. One is to kind of tell the U.S. to back off. He's doing the best he can. Mm-hmm. The second is to tell the international community that, you know, again, the same message effectively, that he's doing the best he can. Another, though, is the Afghan domestic audience, and he's trying to prevent the perception developing of him that he is simply a lackey of the United States and the international community. And so I think some of his intemperate outbursts were very dramatic attempts to kind of, you know, say, I'm my own guy, and Afghanistan is a sovereign nation, and I'm its leader. Karzai is coming to Washington in early May, and I expect that a lot of the recent difficulties will be in a concerted way sort of dealt with, addressed, papered over, et cetera, and we'll see a lot of bonhomie between the two governments. Yeah.
Our guest, Devin Haggerty, professor, currently chair of political science at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org, WILLPLEDGE.org. Now here's your program.